Welcome to Beyond Leading, the podcast that cuts through the noise to get real about leadership, team dynamics, personal growth, and the messy, brilliant reality of work, life, and everything in between. Each episode brings grounded insights, sharp truths, and honest conversations with experienced leaders and coaches as we explore what it really takes to lead well today. We don't deal in one-size-fits-all answers. We spark ideas, offer grounded perspectives, and create space for you to work out what fits your world. So let's get into it. In part one, Dr. Calvin Lightbody and I discussed what well-being really means and why so much of what passes for it at work, the fruit bowls and the yoga sessions, is really wellness dressed up as something deeper. We talked about the difference that actually matters, the warning signs leaders are so good at ignoring, and why even strong, resilient people break when the pressure never lets up. That set the scene. But it left the question, what's actually going on underneath for the person who's struggling, and what do they do about it? That's what part two is for. So in this episode, we go deeper. We get into moral distress and moral injury, the slow, repeated wear that can crack even the strongest of us, the particular loneliness of senior roles, and most importantly, the way back, the real, practical first steps if you listen to part one and recognised yourself. Calvin, a very warm welcome back to Beyond Leading. So let's start with our first question. When leaders come to you for coaching, what's the conversation that keeps them coming back? The thing that they nearly always end up saying, even if it takes them a while to get there.
Yeah, I like that. That's a really key point, I guess, to start with. The thing that I've noticed that keeps people coming back, the thing that keeps coming up again and again, is people say to me, Calvin, that coaching just was exactly what I needed at that moment. They've recognized that something needed to change or that something needed to be worked on, and that coaching, that conversation, or even just that time to think was just what they needed at that moment, because they've realized perhaps that, you know, there's the analogy of the warning light on your dashboard, or maybe something that they thought, this isn't working, I don't like where this is going. Or maybe it's that idea of another analogy, when you hear a whisper, you listen to the whisper before it becomes a scream. So that's what I'm hearing time and again. That's just what I needed in that moment, because I could see things were either not working, or I didn't like the way things were heading, or certainly I was worried about this particular thing. Maybe it's a physical thing, maybe it's a well-being thing. But that's what keeps coming up, and that's what people say. That's just what I needed at that moment.
Tell me, one of the things I see, and I'm interested to see if this aligns with you, when someone is feeling stuck, I often see that particular leader, for example, the instinct is they want to work harder. Mm-hmm. They want to do more. They want to push through. But from your experience, why doesn't that work? What is it? What is that masking typically?
You know, I think that's just the instinct that we have, you know, particularly if you are a leader, you know, particularly if you've got through your career by working hard, you know, maybe that your career has been like a ladder with various rungs that you've worked hard to get up each rung. So it's natural, it's totally normal to think that you just have to keep working hard to get up the next rung or to stay on this particular ladder. But once you're up a little bit higher, once you've been working for some time, I think there needs to be a pause. You know, this is true about many things, but you need to take a pause and maybe take a little step back and have a look to see, right, is this actually the right ladder? Or maybe even, is this ladder even against the right wall for me at this time in my life? So the instinct might be to work harder, but actually we need to take a step back, pause and think, is this actually the right thing for me? Because maybe it isn't a question of working harder. It's maybe a question of, right, actually, what are the priorities for me just now? Do I need to have a re-evaluation of my priorities? What am I valuing in this moment? What are the things that I need to consider or of value to me? Because it might just be that you're working hard because that's what you've done, that's what you're familiar with, that's what you're comfortable with. But actually, is that leading to good value for you? Is that delivering what you want or where you want to be? And again, just coming back to the first question, that's what people say. You know, I needed just to realize that maybe where I was going wasn't the right direction for me. And that's the reason I was stuck. It isn't because I wasn't working hard enough. It's because of what had perhaps happened in that moment or had been going on for some time and was now becoming an issue.
So do you feel part of this is that we just have no one to talk to? Because the old analogy is, you know, the higher we go up the chain, you know, it's lonely at the top as a leader. Is this part of what's going on, or is there something else? I mean, I'm just thinking an example story. You know, you've talked about where your clients have benefited from coaching with you, but is there a kind of story linking what you've just said there with the priorities and the values, and where did we come from and where did we get to?
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. You're right on the money there. Thinking in healthcare, I mean, when you're a junior doctor, you've got somebody who's your supervisor, you might have a mentor, and you've got all that kind of help in place. Similarly, if you're a junior nurse coming in, you'll have somebody that you're working with, a supervisor, again, somebody helping you. You maybe have strict things that you need to work to progress. And as you get higher and higher up that ladder, that support network tends to drift away. You don't have a supervisor. You don't have a mentor. You're very much on your own. Now, I guess that's maybe the same in the business or corporate world, that once you're the leader, once you're higher up in an organization, there isn't the same kind of supervision. There isn't the same framework. There maybe isn't the same guidance. Certainly, there maybe isn't somebody you can consider a mentor that you can turn to and look for. So, yeah, I totally agree that it can be a very lonely place. Certainly, thinking about some of the senior managers that I've had as clients, that's a recurring thing that comes up for them, that they feel that they're kind of looking around and go, right, where do I get help here? And the idea of even like imposter syndrome that they felt maybe would go away as they get higher up the ladder, actually it doesn't go away. It maybe gets more intense. That feeling of uncertainty that you're maybe not able to do the job, you're waiting for that tap on the shoulder of, what are you doing here? So yes, absolutely. I think you're spot on to say that it's lonely. It's lonely at the top. It's lonely in senior positions. But that just makes it all the more important then to maybe just pause and think, right, maybe I do need a little bit of help. Maybe I do need to get another voice here. Maybe I do just need some space and time to think and to think, you know, with a little bit of help, maybe a little bit of consideration of what's happening for me at this time, what's happened to me.
Does this link to vulnerability, that part of, for some of us, we don't like showing vulnerability, and actually maybe admitting that to somebody, that we don't know what to do, we are stuck, we need another piece of advice? Because what is interesting from some of the leaders I work with, they perceive that as being a weakness, but I turn that around and say, but we can't know everything. That's why we need a strong team around us, so collectively we can work out what we need to do going forward.
No, 100%, absolutely agree. I think that people, you know, particularly successful people who have achieved a lot in their careers, but who have got to a high level in whatever their particular role is, all of a sudden, yeah, they might feel that I can't possibly ask for help because that would make me look weak. And certainly you maybe want to not look weak in front of people who report to you or who are junior to you. And you wouldn't like to think that they would know that you needed help. Mm. That might feel that you'd be undermined in some way. But I think you're quite right. That absolutely needs to be turned around into a position where actually I'm doing what I need to do here to be the best version of myself. And I'm doing this to get the help that I know that I need. You know, again, come back to that sporting analogy. If you're an elite athlete, you don't do it your own. You don't get to the top of your game on your own. You need a coach to help work on your game and to push you, to nourish you, to encourage you, but also to help you use the time of rest and reflection to build and develop. And that's true for everyone in a senior leadership position too. You need that time of recovery, reflection and development to be the best version of yourself. I think the uptake of coaching, I'm just again thinking about in the health service, is quite poor, because people seem to think that coaching is something that people who are failing get. You know, you need to coach if you're not doing a great job. And I try and repeatedly say, look, that's the exact opposite of for the position. The exact opposite is true. Getting a coach helps you be the best version of yourself, to be the optimum of what you can be in your current position. It's absolutely not about failing. But it's being honest that it is about saying, well, yes, I do need a little bit of assistance to direct me to be the best version of myself. I maybe just can't do all that on my own. And I think, again, like you, I think it's certainly a very positive thing to engage with. And again, there's this idea of a coaching culture where it's maybe not terribly present in the United Kingdom, certainly not present in the health service, but a coaching culture where you do have that time to reflect and think right to the end of your thought and do some really positive work with a coach or in a culture that promotes that idea. So yeah, that's what I think that's missing just now. But it's certainly not about failing. It's certainly not about being weak. It's certainly not about struggling. It's the opposite of those things.
That leads me on, and what you've reminded me about there is something we touched on episode one, to do with moral distress, because you mentioned it briefly. But I think it would be worth understanding, what is it and how is it different from ordinary stress or pressure?
Okay, let's just explore what moral distress is in a bit more detail. First of all, I think that might be useful. So moral distress is where you see or exposed to or you're involved with something that clashes with your moral code, what you would think would be the ethically correct thing to do, and it makes you feel uncomfortable. There might be a mental or might be a physical discomfort that you feel when that thing is happening. So it might be something that you've seen, maybe at work, maybe something that you've done now in a medical context, that might be something to do with patient exposure or a particular incident at work. But it can also be to do with resources too. It can be to do with resources that you feel maybe haven't been in place, maybe haven't been provided, perhaps by management or by a senior or organizational level to let you do what you need to do. So for me, what I've experienced in terms of moral distress would be all the patients that are lying on trolleys on a corridor in my accident emergency department, and I can see the immiseration that happens in that situation, and the fact that it's so uncomfortable to see that happening. So I guess moral distress perhaps maybe has its history and its background in a more military setting. So you would have had soldiers who were exposed to combat and would have seen horrendous things in a war zone. They would have experienced moral distress from what they've seen and what they were involved in. And they may have become injured morally by that. So moral injury is a more kind of perhaps extreme or detailed version where that exposure causes actual harm. But bringing it back to the more workplace environment, that distress happens whenever you see involved in something that clashes very strongly with your moral code, with your ethical view of what is the right thing to do. I'm pretty sure that applies in maybe a business or corporate world as well. It doesn't necessarily have to be a human thing. It could be, I don't know, maybe seeing people made redundant, maybe seeing people laid off, maybe seeing people struggle in a particular workplace, or just seeing things feel in a particular way. I'm pretty sure in a high stress, high stakes environment, irrespective of what that might be, whether it's legal, education, business, whatever, that something that clashes very strongly with what you believe to be the right thing to do will result in moral distress. The analogy that I like here is the egg, like an ordinary hen's egg, which is actually quite strong. You know, an egg can actually take quite a lot of pressure, can take quite a lot of, you know, hitting and so on. But even a strong egg, if you take that egg and you tap it repeatedly on a surface of some kind, that repeated tapping, even a light tap, over a period of time will eventually crack the eggshell. So something that was initially strong has been cracked by repeated little small taps on the surface. And for me, that's a little bit like the moral distress that can happen over time. It isn't maybe just one major incident like you might see in a war zone, But it's something that happens insidiously over time with a very small repeated pressure, more of a repeated injury, if you like, a small pain, I guess, repeated and repeated and repeated over time. That results in the egg cracking. And yeah, I guess that's what I can see in people that come to coaching that I've seen, you know, in my own workplace. That harm that happens insidiously leads to damage over time.
So we've mentioned coaching as an option to try and resolve the moral injury or the moral distress, but what else, if we can't get access to a coach, what else do we do? If we feel, you know, there's areas there that are causing us moral distress, what could we do now? If we're living it today, something's come up even this morning, what do we do?
Okay. Well, I think it's maybe important just to spend a moment on what people tend to do with that situation. Now, what I've noticed what people tend to do is what I would describe as maladaptive coping. So maladaptive coping is where you do things that you try to cope with a situation, but it's probably potentially harmful or it's a negative thing to do maybe for your own wellness. So the classic example would be drinking. So drinking too much alcohol, drinking in response to the distress that you've experienced at work over a long period of time. That would be the kind of classic maladaptive coping strategy. Other things would be like gambling and maybe letting your relationship deteriorate, things like that. So that's what people maybe tend to do. And that's the kind of normal reaction to that kind of distress. What I would suggest instead is that something that's happened, even if it's something in one moment, is taking again that pause, taking a step back and trying to give yourself a chance to understand what's happened, to maybe download to another person, whether that's a spouse, a family member, a close friend, or maybe it's a trusted colleague at work. It's really helpful just to spend some time talking about that. Talk about your experience, talk about what's happened, and just get it out. I mean, the whole idea of bottling these things up is what maybe causes some of the harm a little bit further down the line. So trying to make sense of it, talking about it, getting that out to whoever that might be is a really positive, that's an adaptive way to cope with something of that nature.
Calvin, this is now getting me thinking as well. So we're talking to people, we're trying to vent, get it off our chest, because actually sometimes what I see with clients when we do that, we actually start to answer our own questions. It's amazing the power of communication. And for many of us, and I particularly see it with younger people, we're doing less of that. But the power it can have and to help you, you know, it's unbelievable the difference it can make. But part of me is wondering as well, and I'd love to get your view on this. I might have done that and I'm thinking, right, maybe I have some answers, but maybe I don't always have someone I can talk to in terms of a close friend or a family member. Mm-hmm. If I was to journal and maybe start with self-awareness, start with thinking, well, what are my values? What are my principles? Who am I and what is it I want? Would you see that being a good starting point here?
100%. Absolutely. I very much agree. The idea of journaling, again, it's not just a quaint notion. It works. What you're doing with journaling is getting the stuff out of your brain onto a page. You're actually getting it out. A bit like when I talked about getting the feelings and the rawness out by talking. You can do a similar thing with writing. Getting stuff down out of your brain and onto a page is a really positive way to do that. And as you're writing, as you're formulating the sentences, you're thinking, you're articulating. You're maybe like, again, the analogy of disentangling a knotted ball of wool. You know, that absolutely helps with that disentanglement, with that straightening out and with making sense of the issue. And I guess the problems that arise, the harm that can arise is because maybe we just haven't been able to make sense of a particular situation. And when we start to ruminate where you're going round and round with the same issue in your mind going over and over again. And having that idea of of journaling, of writing, of getting those things out. Absolutely, it's a good shout.
Calvin, we've talked a lot about what I could argue is the theory around the topic today, but have you got any real world examples that you could explain so our listeners really understand kind of the process at the start and actually where they can get to at the end?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I just think about some of my past coaching clients. I think about one senior manager who'd worked on the COVID ward in 2020-21, and had seen so many people coming in, terribly ill, and many of them died. And he was thinking, did I do everything? Did I do everything for those patients? Did I do the best thing? You know, obviously he did. But just the fact that he was seeing that those people dying, so many in that terrible time, even though he'd done his best, he still had that feeling of, did I do enough? Did I do a good enough job? And that doubt that pervaded through that time. The coaching work for me there was about just coming back to the very basic stuff about, did you do a good job? Tell me about what happened. Let's think about that. Let's talk that through. What did other people say? What did your friends say? What did your colleagues say? And basically, is that true? Was that true that you did a good enough job? And actually, yes, it was. And it was like that unburdening, that sharing, just to discuss that he had done a good job and he had given his best, that satisfaction that maybe comes with knowing that you have done a good job, even in terrible circumstances.
When we look at ourselves, we think of what's not good as the first thought, not what did we do well. But I wonder if part of that is that perfectionism that I see in many of us, where we are setting a bar so high that I could argue for many is unrealistic. And as a result, unless we're reaching this very high bar, we didn't do a good job. And then the more we keep telling ourselves that, the more we push ourselves down, the more we impact our energy, the more anxious, the more fear, the more stress it starts to drive. It's about looking at ourselves through a lens that is true, not one that we're assuming or interpreting, but it's actually not correct.
For sure. I guess it's easy to fall into that kind of tunnel vision setting where you don't see the bigger picture, you just see what's in front of you, and you again just want to keep working, want to keep doing what you've done before, and perhaps you're not able to see the bigger picture because you maybe just haven't been able to pause and take a step back and look and maybe get that help to look. I can see the overlap there for sure.
But have you come across an example with a client whereby we've gone through, the discussions and we've tried to look at ourselves better, we've unpicked what's really going on, but actually the best answer or the best solution for them was to change jobs, was to move on, because the environment just didn't work for them?
I haven't had a client that's like had to leave or quit their job, but I've had several clients who've had to totally change how they look at their job and had to totally change what their values were, particularly when they could see that their job was perhaps starting to cause harm. Now we've talked about moral distress, and we've maybe touched a little bit on moral injury, where that the egg isn't just cracked, it's starting to break. And I've certainly seen that. Again, I can just think back to a senior clinician that I had as a client, who realized that his job was perhaps getting to the point where it was starting to affect his health, and that really just needed to realign what his values were. He'd had a particular health incident that maybe prompted him to think about the bigger picture. And just realised that actually what was important to him was his family. He had three young girls, and he wanted to see them grow up. He wanted to see them flourish, and realised that perhaps the amount of hours he was spending at work wasn't being very good for his marriage, and that he'd neglected his physical wellness. He used to run half marathons and so forth. So that had all just fallen by the wayside. So again, it comes back for me that kind of tunnel vision idea that you just have to keep working. You have to be the provider. You have to carry that burden persistently. And yeah, whenever you just think about what is actually important here, what are the things that I value? What are the things that are precious? And really, it's not about the next rung on your particular career ladder. Really, it's maybe about your health, your well-being, your family, the people that depend on you. Maybe it's something outside of work that's important to you as well, something in the community or something that you're involved with or a particular interest group, whatever that might be. Those things are precious and valuable too. We can sometimes lose sight of that though whenever work is hard, whenever we're working in a particularly high-stakes environment. And it can become that kind of all-pervasive, all-consuming world that can be quite difficult to see out of. But having that time to speak about it, to talk about it, to think about it, you mentioned journaling, I think that's a great shout, is so key, I think, just to helping unravel some of that tangled mess.
So, Calvin, to wrap up then, for the leaders or the working professionals that have just recognised themselves in our two episodes on this topic, what's the one thing you would get them to do tomorrow morning to start?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the key thing, as you said, recognize that they need something. And that's actually the key, really, is recognizing that and realizing that, yes, maybe that warning light is on my dashboard. Maybe there is a whisper that I'm hearing of that there's a problem that might become a scream in the future. Maybe I do need to look at that. So that's the first thing, to realize that there is an issue. Then to pause. To pause and take a step back and look at the bigger picture. Not thinking, what's wrong with me? Why aren't I doing a great job just now? Instead thinking, what's happened to me? Or what is happening with my work, with my life just now? And that really turns it around from something that's internal to something that's external. Because if something's a struggle, if something's maybe becoming harmful, it's something that's happening on the outside, and that's where we need to look. That's where we need to pay our attention, show our attention to. So that's where your control still lies. You still have that control. You still have that ability to choose to take a step back and to choose to do something about it. And then to trust that that's the right thing to do. To trust that speaking, journaling, getting help, getting coaching, maybe it's getting a group of colleagues together, perhaps. Whatever it is, that is actually a really positive thing to do. That's a sense of mature, engaging, adaptive thing to do. And it might be something that's really crucial, actually, for your success in your career, not just in your work, but how you are as a person. Because you're not just a work person, you are everything else, to your family, to your friends, to your community, and all those other things too. It's not just about that one work thing. Like, I'm sure if people are maybe listening to this episode and maybe recognizing some of themselves and what we've talked about, maybe even some little light bulbs of insight happening. You know, I think it'd be really great just to maybe hear some people's questions, some situations that people might be experiencing, and perhaps we can answer those. Can we discuss those in a podcast?
I think that's a fantastic idea, Calvin. Yes, let's do another episode, a part three to this, based on our listeners' questions, and we can target them specifically. Love that idea.
Yeah, I'd love to hear from folk, and you know, people will learn from other people's experiences as well. You might be surprised how similar your own experiences are to other people, what they've already happened.
Okay. The contact details I'll put onto the episode show notes. And then if you send the questions to me, I will then work with Calvin and we'll get the part three of this episode purely on Q&A that you send us.
Yeah, I think that'd be great. And plenty of learning for everyone.
Absolutely. Fantastic. Look, Calvin, thank you so much for your contribution over the past two episodes. I love the way you've kind of brought this to a conclusion. Certainly lots for us to think about and hopefully lots of questions that we'll receive going forward. If you'd like to have a further conversation with Calvin, you'll be able to find Calvin Lightbody on LinkedIn. He is also the author of The Frayed Bandage, which is on Blogger. So, Calvin, thank you very much for all your insights. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks, Alec. Really enjoyed the conversation. Really appreciate you having me on. All the best.
Thank you very much. And until next time. Thank you for listening to Beyond Leading. If this episode was useful, follow or subscribe so you don't miss the next one, and share it with someone who'd appreciate it. And if you've got a minute, a quick rating or review really helps more people find the show.